Hey, I really appreciate the chance to speak with lawyers. Sometimes my colleague Drew Barrett and I give talks on public health ethics, and we often include a section on law because in public health departments, it's often the counsel that is first given the question of what we should do, and we've been told that the lawyers don't want to answer that question. They'll tell you what you can do, what you legally, you know, cannot do, but they want to let you be the ones who decide what to do. And so the philosophers or an ethicist, they think will tell them what to do. But we, again, don't tell people what to do. We merely make suggestions about how you might go about that. And this has been, this topic of individuality has been something that has interested me for a long time. And it certainly, individualism is something that's we value as Americans, but at a certain point, every value, you know, has limits. And it looks like we're in a situation in this country. I have no relationships to disclose. I think I have to say that.
Yeah.
And so I think we've reached a point, especially with respect to public health ethics, where sometimes the individualism that is so central to American life sometimes seems as though it's a hindrance to doing the practice of public health. And so I think a lot more critique needs to be made from a whole variety of levels on this, and we're going to hit it from three different angles today, but we certainly don't think what we're saying is exhaustive. And so this is a slide that really contrasts clinical ethics versus public health ethics, and what I have in mind here is I'm going to show why public health ethics has to have this collective focus. And many people who are familiar with health ethics or practical ethics are more familiar with clinical ethics and bioethics, so we always like to start off contrasting those. And the first thing you see is that doctors, by and large, treat existing disease. It's sort of reactive, whereas public health likes to look at more upstream or fundamental causes and aims at prevention. Clinicians are usually, you know, people who are doctors and nurses and trained in medicine, and they make medical interventions, whereas public health has a wide array of intervention types and professionals. It can be anything from pollution control, vaccine campaigns, to working with community. So a much wider array. The authority as such of the doctor is based on his personal prestige or the prestige of the profession. He really can't make you take your meds if you decide you don't want to, except in rare cases, if it's something like you have multi-drug resistant TB, in which case a public health official will usually make that decision, because his authority can in many cases be based on police powers. He has the ability to get a court order to make you do certain things. So that also explains the difference between medicine and public health, that public health will often look at law as an ally and tool of the profession, both enforcing laws or creating policy, where doctors and lawyers, when doctors first think of law, they think of lawsuits for malpractice, and so I don't think their relationship is as comfortable. So in the case of a doctor, his primary fiduciary relationship is to his patient, whereas public health often has to take a somewhat impersonal public stewardship approach. You often see this in emergency relief, where the doctor wants to privilege his patient, and if they have to triage ventilators or some other scarce resource, it's often very difficult. It's so ingrained into thinking of a medical professional that his patients are, you know, first for him, that he finds it difficult to rise to that public health perspective where he has to impersonally make a triage decision. So again, you know, medicine is individual patients, public health populations and communities, and then if you're familiar with the three concepts of beneficence, we know about beneficence now, justice, and autonomy. It's all on the left side individualistic. You know, there are justice concerns in clinical care, mainly personal access to care, whereas social justice and health equity are primary, central to public health. You want to get an individual informed consent, but when you're working with a community, you often have to get a community consent, or and sometimes not even a formal consent, but you have to engage with the community, because in the end, nothing you do in public health will actually work unless the people that you're working with are in some ways on board with what you're doing. And then finally, this idea of individual autonomy has become central in clinical ethics and certainly in bioethics. It's almost the presumptive value in those discussions. There's been some attempt among certain bioethicists to move to something they consider or call holistic bioethics or population bioethics. In my view, that's really a step. They're reaching, unbeknownst to them, they're reaching towards public health ethics. Whereas public health ethics, instead of emphasizing individual autonomy, emphasizes interdependence of people and then relational autonomy and solidarity. And I'll talk a little bit more about them. This key concept of interdependence. Interdependence implicates the social dimension of public health. And we all know that what you as an individual do doesn't occur in a vacuum. It occurs in a context, a social context. So what you do can harm other people. You see this most clearly in the case of an infectious disease. You can make someone else contagious. And because you can harm other people, you can harm the rest of the population by some of your individual actions, there's a need to limit that personal autonomy, that personal liberty, for the sake of the common good. And fortunately, public health has police powers where, when it needs to, it can invoke that. And so I would argue that it's more important in public health to talk about relational autonomy, the fact that every decision we make is in the context of other people. And I often like to use this expression. That's I can never figure out whether this is a Kosian or South African, exactly where the tribe came from, but it's Umuntu, Nagabantu, and I think it's the Kosan language, and it's a very succinct expression, which means a person is only a person through other persons. We only become persons through other people. And so we have to think of autonomy, not in this purely individualistic sense, but in the sense of a social context. Likewise, communities are not mere aggregates of individuals. If you were an epidemiologist of the last, you know, like 30 years ago, that is the way you conceived of epidemiology. It was just the end, you know, the individual writ large. And so you just got these aggregates of that. But as we're finding now, when we start thinking of what population does as dealing with communities, we understand that communities are not mere aggregates, not atoms. They have they're interrelated. A community member has social relations. And so when you understand that, you understand then that when bad things happen, case of this Ebola, we really need almost an international kind of solidarity. There are tendencies, I briefly heard a lady today talking about Ebola ethics, that a lot of us want to, sort of run for cover and become very individualistic. This is precisely what we must not do. It's here we really need our sense of solidarity. So collective problems need to be addressed collectively. And to quote the Institute of Medicine, public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. It's both, a collective problem, and the decision-making process also has to be collective. So, and I might add here that we're living in this age where we're transitioning from Health 1.0 to Health 3.0. And Health 1.0 is what we're in now, where we have episodic care. Patients, don't have a patient home. Payments are made on the number of procedures you got, on input, not an outcome. We want to transition, and I think we're in the process of transitioning now to healthcare 2.0, where patients have patient homes, integrated care, more accountable care organizations, and we want to make their payments based on improved health outcomes. And I think the goal is eventually healthcare 3.0, where we have fully integrated healthcare and community health going together. Where public health is fully cooperative and integrated with healthcare, individual healthcare. So that's, I think, where we're going. And so I think we need then concepts and ways of thinking about that that are consistent with that. And when we think of that and going that direction, we run up across this, what we'll call, and I think this was in our panel description, strident individualism. I'll just use that quote. And so where did that come from? Well, I think in the case of America, we've always had this tradition of rugged individualism, the frontier spirit. I remember when I was 10 reading a story about Davy Crockett, and he lived out, you know, middle of nowhere in Tennessee and fought bears and so on. And then I remember someone moved 5 miles away and he said, "I got to move on. It's getting a little too crowded in this neighborhood." And so there is that strong tradition in America of that. And then added to that was this Cold War anti-collectivist sentiment. And this was a deliberate attempt, you know, against the, you know, communism and against the whole idea. Anything that was collectivist was bad and evil and had to be contrasted with, you know, individual entrepreneurship, the American way, etc. So that became subject to the whole Cold War mentality. And then it was reinforced by this notion of market individualism. Suddenly all these Austrian economists became popular, like Hayek and von Mises, yeah. And that is the idea that the market can solve all our problems. We don't need big government to solve anything. We let the market handle. And as we know, the market solves some things, but one of its inherent problems that even Adam Smith recognized was its tendency towards monopolies. And what we see today, even worse, I think, is the ability of people with resources to control the political process. Finally, one of the precursors of this strident individualism is the libertarian tradition. We see it in Mill's harm principle. The only justification in a democracy for restricting someone's personal liberty is if the exercise of that liberty threatens to harm someone else. And so you don't, you're not able then to simply restrict someone's liberty because you think it's a bad lifestyle choice. You know, so what you do behind closed doors is your business, and we have no right to intervene. That's considered the paternalistic or the nanny state. And we see something like this thinking operative in Jacobson versus Massachusetts, where the courts did agree that because there was a harm to other people in having, having small, the spread of smallpox, that the government had the authority to require people to be vaccinated. So that's wholly consistent with that very limited notion of government action. And you see how that works out in the tobacco versus the obesity campaign. We knew for a long time that smoking harmed people, but no legislation. Then, when we learned about the dangers of secondary smoke, then because that harmed someone else, then that gave you a legal purchase, then for saying, okay, now we can pass a whole lot of legislation. Conversely, we see in the obesity campaign, it's harder to find what that direct harm is. And so a lot of people have looked at indirect harms because it costs people, it costs the entire system more. But somehow that doesn't seem to catch as much fire as the idea of you're directly harming someone through secondary smoke. And then, some of you who are political theorists, please give me a lot of leeway here because I'm trying to compress, you know, a big history of social contract theory into one slide. And so I am picking and choosing. And it's going to look a little bit more like Hobbes and a little bit Rousseau and not even a whole lot of them. And what I'm doing is sort of doing a sort of a revisionist history based on, you know, how did we get to this strident individualism from this social contract theory? So I am picking and choosing. And there is a social in social contract theory, and it's the idea that, they invoke this notion of a state of nature. And in a state of nature, everyone's an isolated individual, and they have unlimited freedom. But it turns out that having unlimited freedom is not that good. It's less than a zero-sum game because everyone has their freedom over and against you, and if they feel threatened, they can, they don't have to respect life or limb. They just do what they want. And in the words of Hobbes, life in a state of nature is nasty, brutish, and short. And because of that, some of these isolated individuals decide to get together and limit freedom, limit this natural freedom for the sake of what I would call enjoy civic freedom. So the net benefit of civic freedom by limiting freedom a little bit is a net gain. And I like to use the example of a crowded intersection, say at rush hour. If you have no lights there, everyone descends upon it, everyone can just do what they want, you'll very quickly have a bottleneck, and you'll end up having actual less real freedom than if you invoke a stop sign, traffic signals, traffic cop. So by limiting freedom, natural freedom, you actually end up with more real, what I'm calling civic freedom. So I think there is basis in social contract theory for building some positive ideas. Okay, I have 5 minutes. So, but the part I think that is sort of odd about this theory is that, at least in Hobbes and certainly in Rousseau, the social is considered artificial. You know, humans are isolated individual. Society first comes into being through this political act. And for Rousseau, society itself is even a corrupting influence. So that's a very unusual notion. I think it's idiosyncratic. When you look at other cultures, and both in the earlier, say, Aristotelian tradition, man is a zoon politikon, a political animal. It's always been that the idea is that society and politics is a natural state of human beings. Whereas from this theory, the social and the political realms are artificial and in some ways corrupting of human life. And so even though those theorists themselves don't actually, they have qualifications, we don't know if this actually was the way it was historically. Nevertheless, this is the founding myth and one of the key ideas of our political tradition, that the political and the social is something artificial. And so I think it eclipses, in some ways, the picture of the social. And I want to argue, I've said this before, a person is only a person through other persons. And if you look at any kind of recent, psychology of development, anthropology, neurophysiology, evolutionary biology, looking at our near neighbors in the animal kingdom, they have social and political organization, that we're built from the physiological ground up as social beings. And it's sort of indisputable. I'm not even going to try to argue that further. And so we have a political theory that is strangely at odds with that conception. So public health needs an approach adequate to the scope of the health problems it encounters. And I'm sure many of you have heard of this ecological approach of Bronfenbrenner. But I'm going to talk more about Kleinman's nosology, his theory of disease, because I think it's kind of interesting. Arthur Kleinman was a medical anthropologist. And in his view, he had three levels. I added a fourth one. And he said that, there's physiological disease, and that's the province of biomedicine, and certainly medicine is fully familiar with that. But then there's also a dimension of human life, the psychological, and its nosological reflex is illness. And illness is your psychological perception, how you psychologically respond to the fact of your disease. I would want to add to that psychological dimension, both the behavioral problems that people have and what I would just call mental illness. And I have it in quotation marks there because there's a certain sense in which that's very physiological. At least certain kinds of mental illness are also very physiological. But I think that what I really found very interesting about Kleinman is he has this notion of a sickness, a social sickness, that there are certain features of the society in which you live that regularly cause either members of the society to fall ill or certain groups, underprivileged groups, to fall ill. And so, that can be linked to social determinants of health and some of the health equities that then they create. So I think when you're trying to analyze things, you want to think of that realm as well. And then finally, I'm going to add a fourth beyond Kleinman here. And I just read about this very, 2 days before I put this together, and it's something called exposomics. And it's this idea that of all the things you are exposed to, from the womb up into the environment. And we know that in the womb, if you're exposed, like if your mother was hungry and was starving, then it can trigger certain genes to be expressed or not expressed. This concept is called fetal programming. And so fetal programming then can sometimes last generations. So I think we need to take into consideration also all the exposures from womb to the environment that affects climate change and so on, and bring it to a sort of, you know, since we need a sort of holistic conception. Can I have time to just explain one other idea?
Please.
Complementary.
Please.
That's a concept from actually quantum mechanics, and some of you may be familiar with the idea that we say that everything is both a wave and a particle, you know, and you can't reduce, it's non-reductive, you can't reduce things to either a wave or a particle, but some things it's more salient. With us, we're more particle than wave, whereas light is more wave than particle. But I remember when I was in high school doing a calculation where I calculated what our wave component is. So everything is like that. I want to claim that all these things are dimensions of human life, the physiological, psychological, social, and environmental, and you can't reduce one to the other. And you have to look what is the salient feature of the phenomenon in question when you're analyzing. And salient can mean either the most obvious or the one that, you know, when the things that seem salient don't work, what might be a more powerful underlying cause. And that's my whirlwind tour of this, and we'll be happy to entertain questions after everyone else has spoken. Thank you very much.
Thank you.